The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. As a favor to our speakers, I was asked, number one, to pull out my cell phone and make sure that it was turned off. And my ringer is turned off, and let's all just make sure that the ringers are off at this time, and that way we won't be disrupting the speakers. Thank you for that. If it makes a weird noise, this would be the time to do it. And welcome, and you may wonder what a person with a badge is doing up on the stage. And that's because I work at the Edgar Allan Poe National Historic Site, which is at 7th and Spring Garden Streets. If you have not been there, please raise your hand. Whoa, hello. Okay, well, myself and my colleague Mary Jenkins are here, and we'll be happy to give you all kinds of information after the event. It is my pleasure to, my name is Helen McKenna Uff, by the way. I am a park ranger at that particular site, and I am a major Poe fan, and it was a thrill to read the two novels that you're going to be hearing about this evening and being read from author Lewis Bayard, who has written A Pale Blue Eye, and has also written Mr. Timothy and a few other novels and some anthologies of stories. And he's written a wonderful mystery, the character Gus, of course, August, which is short for Auguste Dupin, Poe's detective. And so this is a thriller mystery story and very well written. Poe is a character in the novel, someone who of course, Edgar Allan Poe was a cadet at West Point, and so that is the setting for the novel. The mystery happens at West Point, and Poe, as a cadet, is assisting the person who has been hired to solve a murder mystery, a very interesting murder, by the way. And then after Lewis Bayard is done speaking, then Matthew Pearl, who has written The Poe Shadow, and also had written The Dante Club, a best-selling mystery novel, his book, the novel Poe Shadow, has a character, Quentin Hobson Clark. Now, as a Poe fan, I have to tell you what a pleasure it was reading both of these novels and encountering familiar names used in creative ways by the authors. And here in Quentin Hobson Clark, I recognized a disguised name of Arthur Hobson Quinn, who was a professor from the city working at the University of Pennsylvania, who wrote a biography of Poe in 1942. And it's one of the better biographies of Poe because Arthur Hobson Quinn happened to like Poe, unlike some of the other authors of Poe biographies who really don't like Poe at all. And you wonder, how could they stand doing all the research if they didn't like him so much? So, so his protagonist, Quentin Hobson Clark, is kind of a riff on that biographer. But a very interesting story where you have a character, Quentin Clark, who is trying to figure out how Poe died, and then also, as a subplot, trying to figure out who was the model for Poe's detective, Auguste Dupin. So I'm sure you are all conscious of this and you want your book signed, but just in case you didn't get a chance to read both of them, I thought I would just give you a brief synopsis of it. And there's going to be time for questions and answers afterwards. And thank you so much for coming out tonight, and I hope that you'll enjoy this event. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen, and thank you all for coming out. Can someone tell me what the weather is like? We've been inside for the last hour. Is it thundering and raining? Do we get just muggy? I was hoping for some real Poe weather tonight, I have to tell you. But I'm glad you made it anyway. It's so great to be here in Philadelphia. And I have to admit, Helen knows this, I confess this already, I haven't actually been to this particular Poe house. For reasons that I will explain later, I actually have a rationale for that. But I'm thrilled to be here. I'm particularly thrilled to be here with Matthew. We've actually done this before in New York, and I've come to think of us as the Poe Boy Sandwich because our thank you. Our books actually came out on the same day, I believe. And there's a story Poe files will know called William Wilson, in which the title character is menaced by a doppelganger bearing the same name, looking exactly the same, who's constantly following him around and foiling him every time he tries to do some evil deed. And it ends with them having some mortal battle in which the doppelganger is killed, and then, of course, William Wilson dies. And I was kind of hoping it wouldn't have to come to that. So I'm glad that we could find a more civil means of working together on this. And I know we're both animated by our affection for this Mr. Poe character. I'm just going to yak. I don't usually like to read from the book, so I just yak for a little bit, and then Matthew talk. And I think both of us are more interested in any questions that you guys might have. But let me just tell you a little bit about the genesis of The Pale Blue Eye. And by the way, you probably have guessed the provenance of the title, a lot of you. It's from The Telltale Heart. It's the pale blue eye is the thing about the old man that drives the narrator mad, you think me mad, to want to kill him and stuff him under the floorboards. Well, just one of the many rash acts that we find in Poe's work. I had just written a book, as Helen mentioned, called Mr. Timothy, which was based on the grown-up Tiny Tim from A Christmas Carol. And it was a kind of labor of love for me because Dickens had been one of my favorite, probably my favorite writer of childhood, and the one who's been the greatest influence on my work today. And when I started casting about for another involuntary collaborator or another, you know, grave to plunder, I was surprised really to have this name, Edgar Allan Poe, reverberating back to me because, well, surprised for a couple reasons. One is I hadn't read him in something like 20 years. I think we read him at the same time, Matthew. I read him in high school. I had a teacher, a high school teacher, who pushed him on me. He was part of that approved high school canon for some reason, and God knows why, because his stories are often extremely disturbing. But that's where I read all the Dupin stories, The Telltale Heart, and my personal favorite, The Cask of Amontillado, which is, I don't know if any of you have reread that recently. It's a model of compression. And what I particularly love is there's absolutely no backstory to it. You just know that the guy's pissed at Fortunato. Is it Fortunato?
Fortunato.
Yeah. And wants to kill him. You don't really have any idea why. I think from the Silverman biography, he suggested that it was Poe's revenge fantasy against critics. So who knows? Here's this author I haven't read in 20 years. And frankly, you know, if you come up through any kind of English literature program in American universities, you're kind of nudged away from Poe. He's not part of the, you know, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Herman Melville nexus. And even today, there's a very strong anti-Poe streak in our sort of critical culture. We were talking about some of the very famous people who've despised him over the years. Most recently, E.L. Doctorow, who was even named after him. But then I started thinking about Poe, and I started going through the stories, including the Dupin stories, and The Gold Bug, another marvelous story. And I suddenly realized that the reason I don't think of Poe is because he's so imminent in our culture. He's been absorbed so thoroughly into our cultural DNA that we no longer really recognize him. And yet he's there almost everywhere you turn. If you're a mystery writer, he wrote the first detective stories in really any language, I think, the first fictional detective stories. If you're a gothic writer, he was the one who almost single-handedly reinvigorated that genre. If you write about obsession, you can't escape Poe. He's mentioned in, I think you reminded me, he's mentioned in Lolita. And if you write science fiction even, the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, another wonderful work that's much too often overlooked, is a kind of proto-science fiction yarn mated with Treasure Island and an amazing read. So once I got a handle or on this protean genius of Poe, I was really inspired by the idea of paying some kind of homage to him. And what better homage, really, than to drop him into a mystery story, which he himself invented with The Murders in the Rue Morgue and The Purloined Letter and The Mystery of Marie Roget. And so the question then became, well, there were two questions. One was, and this sounds ridiculous to say because authors aren't really known for their mental health, but am I messed up enough to get into Edgar Allan Poe's world? It's a very strange world. It's the kind of world where a man is menaced by his wife's teeth so that when she dies, he goes into somnambulistic trance to her crypt and pries the teeth out of her mouth, only to learn she's still alive. You know, Q screams, you know, ends Q blackout. Poe sort of got all of his manias, his obsessions out there right on the surface. I'm sure he would have denied that he had these. He probably just, he thought of his gothic stories as kind of commercial items that help pay for his poetry habit, I suppose. But he really got it out there, and he wasn't afraid to show people the sort of little goblins behind his closet door. And that's a kind of an inspiring example for a writer, when you go back and see that there was nothing he withheld, there was nothing he censored in his imagination, and thank God. And then, of course, I went back to my previous book, Mr. Timothy, and I happened to stumble on a sequence of the hero is trapped in a burning coffin. And I was struck by how Poe-like this was, the intense pitched melodrama of it. Poe is nothing if not melodrama. I mean, the fall of the House of Usher doesn't just fall, it's swallowed into the earth. You know, there are no half measures in Poe. So without even knowing it, I'd kind of been wandering toward him all along. So it now began to seem faded. And the only question was where to break into the Poe life. The idea of making Poe a character, as Matthew knows, is not original to either of us. It's been happening for quite some time. There's a gentleman in Baltimore named Harold Schechter who's written several Poe mysteries. There's a couple, I'm blanking on the name, on Night Shore, could that be one? There are a couple set in New York. It's really sort of cottage industry. So that the key in my mind was to think larger than cottage. Think one of those gothic mansions in which so many Poe stories happen. And the one thing you know about these mansions is that they have many rooms, some of them known only to the original architect. So the question is just to kind of work your way through the darkness and find your own little room. And certainly Poe's work and his life are short but compendious enough to admit all of us, and many more still to come, I hope. But when in reviewing his life, and my first book was the Lawrence Silverman biography, but I was struck once again by something I'd forgotten, which was the fact that he attended West Point for a very feckless, hopeless 6 or 7 months, beginning in 1830. And I guess the thing that struck me was the thing that strikes most people, is that what was he doing there? Why was that grown poet at West Point? In my mind, the only equally unlikely person cadet was James Whistler, who followed along a generation afterward. And my own father, by the way, who graduated in 1949. So then I started to think about that dichotomy of sensibility. You have Poe, this aspiring romantic poet, you know, very delicate, very sensitive, voluntarily subjecting himself to the hyper-masculine regimen of what was then America's first engineering school. And so that clash of sensibilities started to intrigue me. And then I was started to think about the Hudson Valley, which I don't know if has anyone been to West Point? Has anyone been there? Oh, wow. It is, in my mind, the most beautiful campus in America. And it's certainly one of the most beautiful. I know they don't call it a campus. They call it a reservation. But it's an incredibly beautiful area. And it was really the dominant scenic area of America at that time. It was the area that all the English tourists had to go through when they came to visit. They went up to Niagara, and then they came back around West Point and did the whole tour. So right away, you had this combination of military poetry, and you had this amazing wilderness that surrounded them, because West Point at the time was extremely isolated. That was part of its whole strategic purpose. And one of the gates there is called Stony Lonesome, which is a good description for the place as it was at the time. The next task became finding the right vantage point on Poe. And Matthew handled this problem a little differently, because he takes Poe already dead in the ground, which is certainly one good way to do it. I chose to take him at the other end, which makes our book sort of interesting bookends, if you will. I take him very early in his life, when he's, I think, 20 years old, something around there. He's already been serving in the military for a couple of years, but he's still a young man. He's written two books of poetry, but nobody's read them. And he's very much unformed still. This is a, in my mind, I always saw it as a portrait of an artist as a young man. So I thought, well, we need another character to give us a perspective on the strangeness of this young man. And so I came up with a man named Gus Lander. Gus being my homage to Auguste Dupin. And Landor, Helen and I were talking about this earlier, is from a very obscure Poe piece called Lander's Cottage, which I think, is that set in the Hudson Valley too? I'm not sure. And Gus Lander is a retired New York City constable. He's come to the Hudson Highlands for his health, but his wife has died, and his daughter is gone, and he's drinking too much and getting out too little and hanging around at Benny Haven's Tavern, which is a real life historical place where cadets were known for basically escaping to whenever they got a chance. By the way, you weren't allowed to leave West Point your entire 4 years, except for the summer before your last year. So that summer became a focus of great intensity for these cadets. You think about it, these poor guys, you know, they're stuck here in the middle of nowhere. They did see women sort of in passing at cadet hops, but this was a kind of monastery of feels. So people, years later, cadets still talk about that first summer away from West Point and how they couldn't wait for it to happen. So Gus Lander is called into West Point with this very specific assignment. A cadet has been found hanged. Shortly after that, the body was taken. The heart was carved out of its body. You can probably see what, again, we're prefiguring the telltale heart. And in fact, one of the fun parts of writing the novel was prefiguring, dropping little, you know, hints of stories to come. I should also explain that West Point at this time was a very at-risk institution. It had a lot of entrenched opposition to it. It had only been around for 20-some years. And one of its most virulent opponents was then President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, who was threatening at any minute to close it down. So we have here an institution still in its infancy and still feeling its way as well. And they've decided that rather than call in the Washington brass and get more criticism on their head, they're going to invite Mr. Lander, the retired constable who is legendary for his detection abilities, and have him serve as the consultant, I guess it would be the modern term. So he comes in, and he soon finds, and I will just read a very, very short section if I can find it without just stalling the whole time. He receives help from an unexpected quarter, and this happens shortly after he's been meeting with Superintendent Sylvanus Thayer, another historical figure now known as the father at West Point, but then very close to losing his job. And Lander has wandered into the superintendent's garden, and he says, "From behind me stole a voice, speaking under great compression, 'Pardon.' And that was when I turned and found him, half hidden behind a St. Michael's pear tree, as unreal to me then as a leprechaun. For hadn't I already watched or heard the cadets of the academy being marched to breakfast, dinner, supper, marched to class, parade, barracks, marched to sleep, marched awake? I had come to think of these boys in the passive voice, and the idea that one of them could split from the ranks and pursue a mission of his own, more urgent than dipping a toe in the Hudson, was as likely to me as a rock sprouting feet. 'Pardon me, sir,' he said. 'Are you Augustus Lander?' 'Yes.' 'Cadet fourth classman Poe at your service.' Start with this. He was too old, at least when set next to the other members of his class. Those boys still had garlands of pimple on their jaws. They had big hands and receding chests, and they startled easy as if the schoolmaster's switch were still singing in their ears. This plebe was different. The pimples had scarred over, and the bearing was erect, like that of an officer on convalescence. 'How do you do, Mr. Poe?' 2 strands of lank black hair hung down from the absurd leather cap, making a cameo of his eyes, which were hazel gray and much too large for his face. His teeth, by contrast, were tiny and exquisite, the sort you might find on the necklace of a cannibal chieftain. Delicate teeth, as fitted his frame, for he was thin as straw, slight, except for that forehead which even the hat could not contain, a pale and hulking thing. It bulged through its envelope in the way an anaconda's meal makes a knot of protest in its neck. Sir, he said, unless I mistake, you have been tasked with solving the mystery surrounding Leroy Fry. That's so. The news had not yet been made official, but there seemed no point denying it, and in fact the young man was under no illusion I would, though he did hesitate long enough that I felt obliged to ask, what might I do for you, Mr. Poe? Mr. Landor, I believe it incumbent upon me and the honor of this institution to divulge some of the conclusions which I have reached. Conclusions? Regarding L'Affaire Fry. He threw back his head as he said it. I remember thinking that anyone who used a phrase like L'Affaire Fry should probably throw back his head exactly like that. I'd be most interested to hear them, Mr. Poe. He made as if to speak, then stopped himself and cut his eyes both ways, assuring himself, I suppose, that no one could see, or more likely that I would pay him the greatest possible notice. Stepping at last from behind the tree, he stood in full view for the first time and whispered in my ear, "The man you're looking for is a poet." And with that he touched his hat, took a deep bow, and marched away. When I next saw him, he had merged with no apparent effort into the stream of cadets proceeding to mess. Lost in a cloud most of our meetings, only when someone becomes vital do we try to give that first encounter the importance it would later have. Although, if we are to be honest, that man, that woman was just a face or a circumstance. In this case, however, I have to believe my first impressions were every bit as full as the later ones, for the simple reason that nothing about him was quite right or would ever be. So that's their first meeting. They will develop a rather profound bond in the course of investigating this crime, a crime in which, I should add, Edgar Allan Poe is at various times a suspect. I should also add that he was almost never known as Edgar Allan Poe during his lifetime. That was mostly by his wishes because, in fact, the book discusses his falling out with Mr. John Allan, his foster father, who is just a few days away from washing his hands thoroughly of Edgar. And then the last thing I'm going to read is very short, but I read it because when I started thinking about this book, the first thing that got me really excited was the idea of writing a poem, an Edgar Allan Poe poem myself. This caused problems with an NPR interviewer who was looking for it in Poe's collected poetry. I spent an afternoon. I said, well, if you'd read to the end of the book, you would have known that it wasn't actually a poem, but that's not, they don't have time. So it goes like, mid the groves of Circassian splendor, in a brook darkly dappled with sky, in a moon-shattered brook raked with sky, Athene's lissome maidens did render obeisances lisping and shy. There I found Leonore, lorn and tender, in the clutch of a cloud-rending cry. Harrowed hard, I could aught but surrender to the maid with a pale blue eye, to the ghoul with the pale blue eye. This poem is actually written in the same meter and rhyme scheme as Ulalume, one of my very favorite Poe poems. And the last thing I'll say is that there, and Matthew will talk about this too, there's an active presumption in portraying any historical character in the pages of a novel. And it seems the level of presumption seems far higher somehow with Edgar Allan Poe. And while I was writing the book, I had on the shelf overlooking my computer an Edgar Allan Poe action figure. Matthew has the same one, and there really isn't a lot of action to it. There's a detachable raven. That seems to be about it. But it seemed highly symbolic to have Edgar Allan Poe sort of looking over my shoulder while all this is done, and I alternated between thinking that he'd be flattered by the fact that all these people were still writing books about him and still curious about him and still wanting to experience him and his work, and plotting some terrible, bloodthirsty revenge, the nature of which I can only dream. So only time will tell. But thank you very much.
Great. Well, thank you for Helen's introduction earlier, and for all of you for coming today. And as Lou said, it's great to have another event together as we did in New York. I vividly remember when I found out that there was another Poe novel coming out. It actually wasn't the first time it happened to me, because my first novel, which is called The Dante Club, it was slightly different. It wasn't the same day. It was something like 4 months before my book was coming out. I got a call and from a friend who worked at a literary agency that wasn't my literary agent, and said, there's another Dante thriller coming out 4 months before your book. And this is exactly the nightmare that you have as a writer, is that someone else, somewhere else, is writing the same book you're writing, and it's going to come out 4 months before yours or a day before yours. And then I called my agent in a panic, and I said, there's a book coming out, and it's about Dante. And she said, oh, yeah, we know about it. We didn't want to tell you because we knew you would freak out. But we have a copy right here, an advanced copy, and she FedExed it over. And I didn't even want to see it. I had my girlfriend at the time, I made her look at it, and she said, don't worry, it's not anything like your book. And it wasn't. It was about it's called In the Hand of Dante. We could plug that one, I guess. In the Hand of Dante by Nick Toshis, who some of you might have heard of that. No? Well, that's okay. No, I'm joking. It's about the mafia stealing the manuscript of the Divine Comedy, which doesn't actually exist, but he imagined if it did exist and the Vatican held it under wraps and the mafia steals it, so completely different. In any case, so it was sort of funny when, or something like funny when I heard that another Poe mystery was coming out the same day as mine. But this time I felt a little more mature. I was a couple years older and I had known Lewis's work by reputation as being excellent, and so instead of getting upset, I emailed Lou and said, hey, we have Poe books coming. You know, it's when you're a writer, it's easy to be, what would the word be, sort of hostile to, I mean, you're hostile. I remember with the Dante Club, any other book with the word club in the title, I was angry at, and any book that came out the same time as mine or that was near mine on a shelf or whatever, anything, you're very protective. So I think you have to, at least I had to sort of grow out of that a little bit and realize it's actually one of the creative industries that's not at all a zero-sum game. It's not that if your book is out there, then it's going to prevent another book from being out there or vice versa. Whereas in film, for instance, because so few films come out, if there's two Robin Hood movies coming out, you remember this when the Kevin Costner Robin Hood movie came out, there was also another one. One of them will probably be pushed aside. So I actually think that the fact that we've had our books together has been a wonderful thing. We've gotten to speak about it together. They've gotten attention as sort of a package together. And as Lou says, they're sufficiently different that we get to have fun talking about them from their different angles. But there is that bit of a doppelganger scenario. And in the spirit of that doppelganger scenario, I'll probably speak more or less like Lou did about the genesis of the project and sort of the thoughts behind it, as opposed to reading much from it. In fact, I don't even have it with me, so I'm not going to read from it. Poe's death was something that I had known about from the very first time I had read Poe, and as Lou said, when I was in high school, and as he did when he was in high school. And as many of you probably did when you were in high school, that's our introduction to Poe, right? Ironic a little bit, because in Poe's own day, you would never, no high school aged person would be encouraged to read Poe. Poe was considered too graphic, too gruesome, too strange, too weird, a word that was constantly used about Poe, too fantastical, and really irresponsible for anyone to read or to be encouraged to read who was young. So it's strange how fate works that's where many people read or are introduced, at least, to Poe. Another irony to it is that Poe, something I didn't know until I started researching Poe applied to be a high school teacher. Applied for a job as a high school teacher. He got rejected, though. Maybe a good thing, since he did marry his 13-year-old cousin. Maybe we don't want Poe teaching freshman English in high school. But I remember when I first read my edition of Poe's stories, in the preface, it mentioned Poe's mysterious death. It said almost nothing else about it. Maybe it said he was found in a gutter, which is not true, but one of the words that gets repeated in the Poe death narrative. And so when I sat down to try to think what I wanted to write next. So this was, I have a friend named Michael Lowenthal, who's a wonderful novelist, and I saw him speak once, and he said something very smart, which is the biggest shock when you finish your first novel is that you have to write another novel. And it's true. You put so much into yourself in that first burst of speculation and of creativity that it's a strange adjustment that you have to make for yourself when you pick another project. And my mind returned to that instantly. And obviously, the first thing I had to do was expand on that short sentence in my high school edition, which I still have, that Poe's death was mysterious. There are actually an enormous amount of theories about Poe's death. In fact, if anyone does anyone grow up thinking Poe died one way or another that you want to shout out? Alcohol is one of the most common ones. Anyone else? Meningitis, that's one. What was the? Drugs, that's another one. Any of the other wilder ones? Rabies, that's one of the popular ones that came out in the 90s. Diabetes was another one, yeah. These are a lot of the medical ones. Beaten, yes, murdered. So actually, if you go to Richmond, to the Poe Museum in Richmond, another great place to visit in addition to the Poe House here, which obviously everyone should go to, including Lewis. You never told us why you didn't get there, but maybe we'll get to it in the questions. The Poe House in Richmond has a whole wall of cubes, and you spin the cubes, and each cube, on each side of each cube, is another theory about Poe's death. And that's what it feels like often, that it's sort of, you know, you spin the wheel and take your pick. There's so many theories, and you named a good selection of it. Being beaten or murdered is one of the wilder ones. Murdered because he was engaged to a woman named Elmira, who had also been his childhood sweetheart, and now he had been reunited with her, and her family didn't want them to get married, so they beat Poe up and left him for dead. There's also one called cooping, some of you might have heard about. Okay, that's cooping isn't a word we use, at least in this context, anymore. It was a form of political violence where you would be kidnapped and forced to vote again and again and again all over a city on election day, and in the process potentially be drugged or made to drink a lot. And the reason that people favor that theory is that Poe was found on October 3rd, 1849 in Baltimore, which was election day. He was found at a place called Ryan's Inn and Tavern that, yes, was an inn and a tavern, obviously, but was also a polling station that day. So you have this possibility that there was, that the election killed him. What we really have are, through the course of time, is looking for different entities or people to blame for Poe's death. The first one we blamed was Poe. When Poe died, we said, well, he drank himself to death. It's his fault. And in fact, the death not only demeans him as a person, but also as a writer. The thinking being that he was excessive as a writer. He wrote too much about violence and grotesque mysteries and weirdness. And he was also excessive as a person. And we should learn our lesson from him and not be anything like Poe. Later, we started to like Poe as a culture and wanted to rethink that and think, well, maybe Poe wasn't that bad. Can we restart the death narrative? And so we looked for other people to blame. Who did we blame? We blamed political corruption, always a popular thing to blame, and it was the mid-20th century when that started to get some traction. So we say, well, it wasn't Poe's fault at all. It was this other entity. It was the government. And then as we got later into the 20th century, we didn't want to blame anyone. We wanted to blame environmental or medical factors. It was diabetes. It was meningitis. It was chemical sensitivity syndrome, thank you, or carbon monoxide poisoning from the lamps in the street. So anything that's sort of the environment, of science that we could point to. So there's a process in which, what are we doing? We're defining Poe however we want to by taking the blank slate of his death and writing a new narrative on it, like those cubes at the Richmond Poe Museum. In some ways, Poe's biography really begins with his death more than it begins with his birth. In fact, very few people know where Poe was even born, park rangers. Does anyone happen to know where Poe was born? No? Baltimore is what many of the obituaries thought when he first died. Boston, that's right. I'm impressed because I live in Boston and I do events in Boston and I always ask and nobody knows. So in Boston, we have a tiny plaque that's probably in the wrong place saying that this is where Poe is born. No one ever sees it. And it's actually strange, and it's something I won't go into, but we can talk about if we want a little later, because Boston really celebrates its literary history, its Longfellows and others who lived there, passed through there, and yet are completely, if you go on the duck tour of Boston, this silly duck machine, right, that goes around, and it points everything out. Not a word about Poe. So we can talk about that. It's a bit strange, but in any case, Poe's birth is really sort of left out, and we, in a way, that the death is where we start. That's part of what makes Lewis's book even more fascinating, is that he takes that space that we see very little of, the youth of Poe, and we get to see some of that. So one of the things I wanted to do was not go backwards and say, well, I want Poe to be this person, and so I'm going to design his death this way. I wanted to imagine, what if someone really investigated Poe's death at the time it happened, not 150 years later, but what if someone that day or that week started to look into it. And so my novel, The Poe Shadow, I try to recreate as best I can what that investigation might have looked at. And as Lewis does in his novel, I, of course, couldn't help but thinking of the mystery genre that Poe innovated, and Auguste Dupin, which I think you pronounce better than I do, but Poe wouldn't pronounce it right either because he didn't speak. Poe pretended to speak French and a few other languages that he studied a little bit, but we don't think he was probably that skilled at them. And the fact that he created this detective fiction really is inspiring when you're a writer, because you get to see the origins of what we take for granted. So we get to see where Sherlock Holmes really comes from. And in the case of my novel, what I wanted to imagine was, well, what if my main character, whose name is Quentin Clark, as Helen mentioned, who is a Poe admirer, hears about that Dupin was based on a real person. I actually didn't make that up. There was an article in the 19th century that claimed that Dupin was based on a real person in Paris. I tried to follow the track of that and see who they were talking about and couldn't find that. So I instead fictionalized that idea to think who this might have been. And I have Quentin travel from Baltimore to Paris to find this real Dupin, convince him to take the case of Poe's death. The problem or the conflict or being in the novel that two people crop up claiming to be the real Dupin and start rival investigations into Poe's death, in which Quentin is stuck in the middle. So thus preserving, I hoped, as a writer designing this novel, the idea that there isn't one story about Poe's death. There's constant competing narratives, and that's part of what I wanted to dramatize in a compressed form of that occurred right after Poe's death, is what has happened for 150 years, that all of these Poe death narratives start gaining their own traction and having their own agenda, and in trying to find the truth, whatever that is, we can often get confused. So I'm looking forward to sitting down with Lewis and hearing more of your thoughts. So I'll just end by pointing specifically to Philadelphia, which is that is the great negative space in Poe's death narrative. What I mean by that is Poe was in Richmond, Virginia, giving lectures. He wanted to raise money for this dream project he had his whole life of owning his own magazine. And he was trying to do this through lectures. And from Richmond, he was supposed to go to Philadelphia, where he had a job waiting for him, a paying job to edit a rich woman's book of poetry. And from Philadelphia to go to New York to get his mother-in-law or former mother-in-law slash aunt, remember he marries his cousin, and bring her back to Richmond where he was going to theoretically get married. He doesn't show up in Philadelphia as far as we know. He doesn't show up in New York. He does show up in Baltimore. But what's interesting is that Philadelphia part of the equation, this negative space because it begs the question, why didn't he get to Philadelphia? Well, the first question, did he get to Philadelphia? If not, why didn't he get to Philadelphia? And what that reveals about what did happen to Poe and where he lands in Baltimore instead of Philadelphia for that final stretch of his life. So Philadelphia plays a critical role, though not geographic, in Poe's final steps. And so it's of particular interest and excitement to think about that surrounded by our Poe environment here. So again, I think that what will be fun is to sort of hear your thoughts on Poe and maybe ask us questions. So can we go right ahead, or someone else might be in charge of that. But for now, I'll say that that's what I'll say. So thank you for listening. Oh, and one more thing. This is the Poe doll. It's not the action figure. This is the Poe doll that also has the raven, and it's also detachable. So this, which I don't understand, maybe someone can explain. I don't know what the circumstances are when you say, well, I'm going to bring Poe, but I want to leave the raven. So we need it, you know, thank God it's detachable. But you can actually buy these if you really like it.
So it's my job to run the Q&A. Folks, if you put your hands up, we will get a microphone to you. Please wait for the mic before you ask your question. Lady in the black right there, about six rows, seven rows back. Yeah, just pull the mic in.
Okay. Lou.
I think we should have smoking jackets.
Yeah, you should, yeah. Thank you very much. This has been great. How well known was Poe when he died? What was his frame of mind at the time? How successful was he? Because I'd heard he was sort of a melancholy sort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe I'll take the part about how well known he was died and his state of mind maybe at that point, and then maybe Lewis can add about his state of mind generally from your observation of him as a young man and also through his life. Poe was, it's a complicated answer. Poe was, although not long, Poe was known, but he was not very celebrated, if that makes sense. So the most frequent appearances of Poe in the media would have been negative ones, that Poe got into a fight or that Poe was drunk, rumors essentially. And there were pieces of Poe's writing that became very well known in his own lifetime, including The Raven. But my conclusion is that when that happened, the pieces became better known than Poe himself during his lifetime, if that makes sense. So almost their popularity almost overshadowed Poe's persona. So he never achieved the fame that he desired. He never came anywhere near someone like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who we've mostly stopped reading today, but in their lifetime was very popular. So when Poe died, there were obituaries, but they were pretty short for the most part. And they often discussed the waste of talent. Now I'll just say real quick, one reason for that is Poe was writing the wrong types of things. So if you wanted to really make your impression on American literature, you were supposed to be writing novels. And Poe only wrote one novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, which Lewis mentioned, although he did say he wrote two novels. Okay, so remember, Poe lies about a lot of things. We assume this is a lie, although I have my suspicions that there might be. He said he published it anonymously in two parts. The reason I'm not so sure that he's lying, if anyone has extra time and wants to try to find Poe's novel, it'll be a big discovery, is that he also said he self-published a book of poems in 1827, and for 50 years everyone assumed this was a lie, until around the year 1937, when we found 1933 rather, when we found Tamerlane, which we just saw a first edition of held here at the library, one of the most expensive books in existence now, self-published by Poe in 1827, a book of poems. So I'm still hoping that novel might turn up. So maybe Luke can say a word more.
That would be great, wouldn't it, if we found a Poe novel. It's interesting because he was known, best known probably for The Raven. Wouldn't you say The Raven was like the equivalent of a number one hit record? It was a hugely popular, a real sensation when it came out. And then probably best known secondary to that as a critic, and quite a ferocious critic, who collected a lot of scalps and, in the process, a lot of enemies, which was a problem for him during his lifetime and after, because his first biography was written by one of his mortal enemies. In fact, Poe named Rufus Griswold his executor, didn't he?
Yeah, or as some people called it, the literary executioner.
Yeah, yeah. So Poe was definitely somebody to reckon with on the literary scene, but there was this feeling that he was hadn't quite realized his potential, that his own temperament got in his way. Yeah. I think James Russell Lowell wrote, "There, Poe with his raven-like Barnaby Rudge, one half genius and one half fudge."
Or three quarters genius, three quarters fudge. Right.
Oh, that, I didn't know, I forgot the ratio. Yeah, three quarters fudge to one.
Oh, three-fifths. Okay.
Fifths, oh,
sorry.
Quarters.
So two-fifths. Well, anyway,
we don't do math. We're English majors. In terms of his melancholy, I think of him more as a manic character, because he had bursts of quite extraordinary energy, and over the course of 40 years managed to leave behind a considerable body of work. So I don't see him as somebody who sat around all day, but he did have black spells. That's
maybe
undone.
Bipolar.
Yeah,
I think definitely be on medication today. Lots of it.
In fact, we talked about this, and if he were medicated, he probably wouldn't have written most of what he did.
I'd also heard that this goes to some of the death theories, that he had a brain lesion too, which was exacerbated by his drinking, and that he didn't need to drink a lot in order to become maniacal.
Yeah, I mean, my conclusion from the research I've done is that Poe... I don't agree with Poe, with the conclusion that Poe is an alcoholic. I think in some ways he was the opposite of an alcoholic. He was someone not who drank to excess typically, although that did happen on occasion, but someone who could hardly drink a minimum amount of alcohol. And we have to remember, we have to have our historical context hat on, that between the years of 1840 and 1850, American males drank more alcohol than any time in the history of the country before or since. And that the alcohol was completely different than what we think of. It was not distilled at all. So the social requirements, remember, you're not being served water. You wouldn't be drinking water. The social requirements of drinking was such that would put someone who is vulnerable to drinking small amounts of alcohol and becoming sick from it in a very difficult position. So there are various theories that come from that about whether there might have been something in the brain or otherwise that caused that.
Another question? Second row here in the middle.
I was somewhat surprised to find out that Poe was considered a transcendentalist author.
Hmm.
And is he... was he looked at as from the other transcendental authors as being respectable? Did they admire his work at all? Was he like within their group at all, or was he just way on the outside?
Where did you see? I actually haven't seen that he's been considered a transcendentalist.
That's interesting.
Yep.
Yeah. He's sort of around in the time, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't. Yeah. He certainly
well, he
didn't
was a
fraternize
contemporary
with Emerson.
Of theirs,
or,
no, no. In fact, he made fun of them. As Lewis said, he was such a caustic critic, and he did make fun of the transcendentalists. So I'm not sure. I mean, there could be a scholar out there who groups him with the transcendentalists thematically, but. Yeah, they didn't like him. Poe actually...
They thought of him at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Poe, this will just fill in a little bit of what I mentioned about Boston. Poe had a horrible rivalry with all of the Bostonians, which would include the Transcendentalists. And so that's part of the reason why nobody in Boston still knows that he was born there, is that Poe defined himself in part against Boston, even though Tamerlane, that first book, is signed by a Bostonian, which makes it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't one of the other reasons that he appointed Griswold as his executor, this man who ended up savaging him early on in his, mm-hmm. just after his death?
Mm-hmm. You mean, what were the reasons, did he say?
Well, he appoints Griswold. I mean, this is one reason he sort of disappears for a while, and he appoints someone who has this immense enmity toward mm-hmm. him as his executor.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know, do you know why that was? Helen?
Griswold was the most successful anthologer of the 19th century. So if you wanted Muddy, the surviving family member, to make some money, then you would have Griswold anthologize your work, because then it would sell.
Right.
Or had a better chance of selling. So he was thinking of her. He was being very conscious of her welfare. Self-sacrificing, I'd say.
And of course it was the French who rescued Poe from oblivion. He had completely fallen into obscurity here. It was Baudelaire and Verlaine and those guys who right. saved his reputation.
In the Blue, about three quarters of the way back.
So why does he rate a National Park Service home here in Philadelphia?
Well, you guys can answer that specifically.
Because he's a good writer? Well, it starts in 1933, Richard Gimbel, that's the Gimbel department store family. Richard Gimbel bought the house that is now the National Historic Site, and he bought it because it was about to be torn down. It was in sheriff's sale. He knew Poe had lived there. Poe lived in Philadelphia for 6 years and happens to be the height of his literary career. He knew no greater success than when he lived in Philadelphia, except for the blip of success that he enjoyed when he published The Raven. So Gimbel operated it as the Gimbel Poe Museum for 30 or so years, and then when he died, he bequeathed it to the city of Philadelphia, who then put it in the hands of the Rare Book Department. And the Rare Book Department was absolutely thrilled to get the daguerreotypes, the manuscripts, the letters, the over 100-year-old house that was crumbling and in disrepair. They thought, maybe we should not take this on. And so they approached the Park Service, and then you have to take these things to Congress, you know, because this is a liability to the American taxpayer. You know, do they want this? So Congress, you have to argue it. And the argument is that Poe is a great poet. He invented the modern detective story here in Philadelphia when he published Murders in the Rue Morgue. He was America's first serious full-time literary critic. Pioneer in science fiction. I am forgetting the fifth genre.
Horror.
Gothic horror. Mm-hmm.
Horror. There you go. Master of the horror story. And really, involved very heavily in the publishing scene at a time when the American publishing scene was exploding. And so this would, all of these reasons would make a compelling reason to come and visit the site, and the fact that he actually lived there. And he wrote The Black Cat while he lived there. And we have the basement that, you know, he seems to be describing in the horror story, The Black Cat, which, Lewis, I wanted to ask you, and I'm just going to take advantage of having the microphone. Were you thinking of The Black Cat in the opening of The Pale Blue Eye?
The Black Cat is in there, this is my chance to say why I didn't go to your part. Because there actually was a method behind that, and it was because I was catching Poe at 20 that I thought I actually didn't want to have him. So I didn't go to Baltimore, and I didn't go to Philadelphia or New York. I went to Richmond and West Point because I kind of wanted it to be as though the other stuff hadn't happened yet. But I'm going to go, I promise.
Another question. In the middle in the white shirt there. Keep your hand up, please. Thanks.
You've mentioned that Poe was very influential on a number of people who followed him, science fiction writers, Baudelaire, but who were the literary figures that Poe himself looked up to, like who were his idols?
Dickens would be one. He met Dickens in Philadelphia.
Yeah, in fact, they met, and it was not a pleasant meeting. We don't know exactly what happened, but we know that when the meeting was over, they didn't really like each other anymore. So I think I would say that Poe didn't usually acknowledge that he liked a writer, or if he did, he would later change his mind and sometimes attack them. So it's a little bit, it's harder than with other writers to identify very specific writers that he would say were his influences.
I would say the romantic poets, certainly in his, if you read his early poetry, Byron. Milton is a big one. Milton's not romantic, but Milton and then Byron, Shelley, I think is very much an influence in him. In terms of the Gothic stuff, I guess Byron had some Gothic elements to his work as well, but I'm not quite sure where some.
Yeah, I think Byron definitely, in terms of how he saw himself in the early poems.
Oh yeah, he idolized Byron. He had a picture of Byron in his room at West Point, his cadet quarters.
A few more questions, lady on the corner here.
This follows up on the manic versus melancholy issue. You probably both know Poe wrote a lot of really daffy, humorous stories as well as horror. And I just wondered if either of you ever feel when reading the horror, especially the fall of the House of Usher, that the joke is still going on, that our leg is being pulled, and that he is at least some of the time laughing at the genre of horror and its over-the-topness, especially in the really gothic atmospheric stories.
Hmm. That's interesting. It's true. He wrote several humorous stories, and I didn't laugh at any of those. But you're right. There are some definitely risible parts of The Fall of the House of Usher. And in fact, if you see some of Roger Corman's movie adaptations, they're all poised just one side of camp or just plunging right ahead into camp. So that works. It definitely lends itself to that.
Yeah, when he's trying to be funny, he's really not. But he can be brilliantly humorous, so maybe better than funny when he's planting it in a story like Berenice, which you had mentioned with the teeth, which is able. I guess the trick is he's able to be horrific and subversive at the same time, as you say, about the genre. And it really is amazing to trace. I mean, it's a slightly long genealogy, but I actually even trace King Kong was invented by Poe. Because The Murders in the Rue Morgue, which was about orangutan, is made into a movie a year and a half before King Kong. And if you watch it, it has the identical structure. It ends with the orangutan, which is a gorilla in the movie, holding a white woman running across the rooftops, and it comes back into fashion because of the evolution debates and sort of the fear of the black creature being too close to the white, particularly the white woman. And King Kong clearly comes, remember the character's last name in King Kong is Darrow, and we're clearly getting straight from the evolution debate via Poe. So it's fun to trace
this. Very interesting.
Things.
Any more questions in the second row here?
I want to say thank you for writing your stories. I really enjoyed them. I got to buy your book,
yeah,
Pale Blue Eye. The Poe Shadow I bought, it was great. And I want to say thank you because you keep Poe out there. And I got a question, though. Why do you guys think they haven't made a movie about his life?
Do you want to?
I don't know.
Well, first of all, thank you for the comment, and definitely get Lewis's book. It's fantastic. I think it goes back to something Lewis said when he was talking, which is that we are so possessive individually of our image of Poe that it would be so difficult to create a character on screen that people aren't repelled by instantly. That said, they have tried. Michael Jackson has been trying to, I don't think it's going to happen, but wanted to have Robert Downey Jr., I believe, playing, and Stallone. Yeah. And Stallone's been, oh no, Michael Jackson wanted himself to play Poe. And Sylvester Stallone wrote a Poe screenplay about his life and death and wants Robert Downey Jr. to play Poe. That's all I have to say about that.
It's a pretty grim life, too, so it'd be hard to happy it up for domestic consumption. There's just not much light there.
Oh. Why don't we wrap it up with one more question? Gentleman in the blue over here.
Just recently I found the letters by Charles Dickens in which he's inviting Poe to his hotel here in Philadelphia, March 6th, 1842. And I looked in the Graham's Magazine. Poe was the editor of that Graham's Magazine. And the previous year, he had published in Graham's Magazine a chapter of Nickleby by Dickens. And they both seemed to, I've read both, and they both seemed to develop into mystery and crime, and I was just wondering what your impressions were of that period or that.
The question being, did Dickens sort of drive Poe in that direction or vice versa?
Just your speculation of how they influenced one another, if they did.
The most obvious one that people pick up on is the Raven, because in Barnaby Rudge, there's a Raven who plays a sort of pivotal role. Go up to the We just saw Dickens' actual Raven that he used as a model for that. It's pretty amazing. And then, as I think you said, they had a kind of slightly frosty relationship. But I think Poe made a point of trying to solve the mystery in Barnaby Rudge before it actually appeared in American shores. I think he drafted his own solution in advance, which was wrong.
It wasn't that it was wrong. It was that it wasn't really as an advance, from what I understand, as he claimed it was, because he had actually seen more of the chapters than he had claimed, because it was being serialized. The frosty relationship had a couple parts to it. One is that Poe wanted Dickens to help him get his own stories published in England, and when Dickens wrote back to him saying, well, I can't really do it, Poe was upset. And then there was a negative review of Poe in London. Remember, back in the 19th century, you would never have a byline, almost never have a byline, so you never knew who was writing something. Not a good situation for a paranoid person like Poe, so Poe assumed it was Dickens. It wasn't Dickens, as far as we can really tell from a scholarly angle. Poe assumed it was Dickens who was trashing his stuff, and from that point, Poe was angry at Dickens. But that's separate from the creative influence, which I think there was some that are obvious and probably some that are more subtle.
But they were both attracted to melodrama and the Gothic very much.
Well, thanks to our two authors, Louis Bayard and Matthew Pearl. I also want to let you know, since you're all clearly Poe fans, that, Jim, I hope I'm not giving too much away. Can I say it about for the bicentennial, the Free Library of Philadelphia has one of the best Poe collections in the country, if not the world. And we'll be having a major exhibit of his work at the bicentennial of his birth. So I'd encourage you all to come see that. You'll read about it in the paper, etc. Thank you again. We'll see you upstairs for the book signing. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.